We'd like to welcome everyone to
Blog Talk Radio.
We'd like to welcome everyone to Africa on the Move. That's right, it's Africa on the Move, a show that is dedicated to serving the underserved communities and speaking truth to power. Today we're going to speak truth to power and talk about a case that has been internationally known around the world, but for some reason or another there has been a blackout inside the U.S., and that case is the Cuban Five. That's right, the Cuban Five. If you have never heard of it, then tonight will be a program that we hope to enlighten you, inform you, not only about the case, but how does it particularly relate to the interests of the African community and why we must join in this just battle to help free the brothers and sisters, Arab brothers and sisters from Cuba. And to discuss this matter today, we have Brother Haki Machoki. He's an organizer for the African Awareness Association. We also have with us Brother Bamboshi Shungo, who is an organizer for the National Network of Cuba and the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC. And we have also Brother Netfa Primo, who is a member of the International Committee for the Freedom of the Cuban Five. They will be giving their perspective on this particularly important issue as it relates to the African community and all freedom-loving people. At the same time, we'd like to hear your feedback. Later on, we will open up our phone line. So right now, we'd like to greet our guests today, Brother Haki, Brother Bamboshi, and Brother Netfa. We'd like to welcome all of you to Africa on the Move. Welcome to Brother Haki.
Thank you, Brother.
Well, Brother, start with Brother Haki. First and foremost, for people who have not had the opportunity to find out who you are, could you just briefly give us a backdrop on who is Brother Haki?
I've been involved in the political struggle for 30 years. Primarily the introduction of institutions throughout the city. There was such a blessing needs in terms of psychosocial material needs of African people. And these are institutions, the means in which to get people thinking about these more complex issues that impact on the people. And that's what I like to speak up with.
Okay. That was Brother Haki. We next would like to introduce Brother Bamboshi. Can you give our people a general backdrop on who is Brother Bamboshi? Brother Bamboshi.
Thank you for having us tonight on this very important subject, Brother Lee. I'm Bamboshi Shango. I'm an organizer with the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC, and I'm also a co-chair of the National Network on Cuba.
Okay, that was Brother Bamboshi. And next we have with us Brother Netfa Frema. Can you give us our people a backdrop on who is Brother Netfa?
Yes, Brother, thank you for having us on the show. I'm with the International Committee for the Freedom of the Cuban Five. I have been in the internationalist human rights struggle and Pan-African struggle for a long time. I was in the All African People's Revolutionary Party. That was where, you know, my political foundation comes from there. So Pan-Africanism, and just very involved with other things related to prison industrial complex, political prisoners, yeah, those kind of things, and trying to connect those things with our people's understanding of our relationship to Cuba and the Cuban Five.
Okay, Brother Netfa, we can start with you first and foremost. Can you just give our audience a sense of what is the responsibility and the makeup of the International Committee for the Freedom of the Cuban Five? What is its role? What is it out to do and why?
Mm-hmm. Well, the International Committee for the Freedom of the Cuban Five is a group of people that connected, and we're in different places around the world, mostly based in the United States, but some based in other countries outside of the United States. And the sole purpose is to to build a movement that will win the liberation of our brothers, the five heroes, the Cuban Five, who have been fighting and their own, who are imprisoned in the United States, and the only crime was to defend Cuba, their homeland, Cuba, against the terrorist operations that have been orchestrated from the United States. And so we try to build this movement. We work with anyone to do it, and we are, you know, yeah, that's pretty much, that's it.
Okay, now, many people have not heard of the case of the Cuban Five. Can you give people a backdrop on the history and nature of the case of how the Cuban Five came to be the Cuban Five? What is so special, unique about this case?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I think we should start off with, often we sometimes forget to do it, but to humanize them by mentioning their names. And I'm guilty all the time sometimes of just saying the Cuban Five without saying who they are. And so one, the Cuban Five are Rene Gonzalez, Antonio Guerrero, Fernando Gonzalez, Geraldo Hernandez, and Ramon Labenino. And they are five Cuban brothers, agents of four Cuba that they were sent to the United States as agents to infiltrate the extremist right-wing groups that have been orchestrating terrorist activities and other destabilization things against Cuba. Mostly they're Cuban Americans. The exile community with a very extremist world view of the world, and they feel justified in just committing the most base acts of terror and murder and horror against people, and think that, you know, they're justified in doing it just because they want to overthrow the Cuban Revolution, and particularly the Castro brothers. And so the Cuban Five were dispatched, and others, along with others, to infiltrate these groups to find ways, because the United States has been unwilling or unable to stop the terrorist acts that have been committed against Cuba ever since the dawn of the revolution, starting with the Bay of Pigs and going all the way up to, you know, in the 2000s, that they've been committing various acts that have resulted in the deaths of over 3,000 Cuban people and maimed or injured over 2,000. And so the Cuban government has been, appealing, reasonably so at least, appealing to the United States to do something about it, since it's being orchestrated from their shores, and the United States has continually refused to do anything about it. So the Cuban government took upon themselves to see what they could do to infiltrate these groups and mitigate the harm that they were causing. And so instead of doing anything about the terrorists, the U.S. government found out who the Cuban Five were and arrested them. They were actually on their trail for a while, and this was prior to the Cuban government presenting evidence, irrefutable evidence, to the United States, to the FBI, and saying, look, these terrorist activities are taking place from your soil, and we think that you would want to do something about it. And instead of doing anything about it, they arrested the Five. And that's who they are. And they arrested them in 1998. And two of them have been released only because they served their full sentences. There was nothing about any kind of humanitarian gesture or anything. But the other three who are imprisoned have longer sentences. I think it's Ramon that is eligible in 3 years. And Antonio has another, 10 or 21 years, a long sentence to go. And Geraldo would never get out if he serves this, and he has two life sentences plus 15 years. And none of them had committed any acts of any violence or any kind of physical acts. It was only about gathering information and actually putting their own lives in jeopardy to infiltrate groups that are very violent and could have killed them or anything. And so these sentences were, leveled down on them, and they were also, they had a trial, and I'll end here. The trial was, they were railroaded pretty much into one of the basic things that railroaded them in the trial is that the trial took place in Miami, which is the only place where they were, but it's the only place, Miami is the only place where anyone who was doing what they could do couldn't even have the possibility of a fair trial. And in spite of the request to have a change of venue, they were denied, and they were forced to hold this trial in Miami. So anyway, I'll end there. There's a lot to it. It's a very simple case, but it's, a lot of details to it.
Yeah, and we're going to talk a little bit about those details. We think it's important to talk about maybe do you detail, because so much has been has taken place since 1998, and so little is known about this case, particularly as it relates to people who may not be aware of it, who comes from the African community. And with the, some of the issues of this particular case, I'd like to raise this question for Brother Bamboshi. Brother Bamboshi, this case has been in existence for over since 1998. Now, what is it about this particular case that make it so strange that the public has a blockade of information on not allowing the public to know the truth? What is it about the case that creates certain issues or uncomfortability for this media not to really share the real truth about what's going on?
Well, I think that Brother Medford just gave you the essence of the case. It is grounded in the fact that Cuba has been looked at ever since the Cuban Revolution in 1958 as a good example, and that the rest of Latin America and the Caribbean and the world would probably follow the Cuban model, the Cuban Revolution, if the United States didn't do something. So since 1958, they have been trying everything which they call something. They have had a blockade on Cuba since 1960, 61. And for the last 18 to 20 years, each year, the international community of the United Nations has voted overwhelmingly. As a matter of fact, so overwhelmingly, last year, the United States had two votes, itself and Israel, and the rest of the world voted to lift the illegal U.S. blockade on Cuba. And so, along with this blockade, they've tried every other thing possible to overthrow the Cuban government and to assassinate the leadership of the Cuban government. And they've been aided, for the most part, by a small group of fanatics in Miami who were part of the Cuban bourgeois, but also part of the Cuban right wing, the Cuban neo-colonial agents per se, whose role it has been to continually harassing the Cuban Revolution, taking strange pot shots at Cuba in every way they can, from literally shooting Cubans, which they have done in the streets of Cuba, in the streets of Miami, in the streets of Puerto Rico, in the streets of Mexico, even in the streets of New York and Washington, D.C. They have tried everything possible to sabotage and overturn the Cuban Revolution with the complete knowledge and assistance of the United States, the State Department, and its CIA and FBI. So this is a continuation of this struggle. Cuba has proven that there is a better way, that there's a way that people can live together, and that the majority of the people can benefit from its society, not just the 1%. And this continues to today. Just 2 months ago, there was an exposure on the fact that the United States government had set up a fake Twitter account with hopes that by using this account, the social media, they could find inside of Cuba people who were in opposition to the government. And they had a whole host of people who were working to identify people who may be in opposition to the government, that they were hoping they could trick into beginning a struggle which they thought everybody else would join, but I don't see why. Because in Cuba, one of the most fundamental things that you observe as soon as you get there is basically there's no homeless. People have houses. People have places to live. They have sufficient food to last them for a month. Now, if they're greedy, they may need more. They have to find other ways of getting it. And they have health care and education. As a matter of fact, Cuba is one of the highest educated communities, not just in the Caribbean, South and Central America, but the world. Cuba, life expectancy is on par with that of the United States because of its wondrous health care system. Their health care system just announced that they have possibly found a cure for breast cancer. They have been able to send doctors, armies of doctors, all over the world, especially to Africa, Asia, and Latin America, which need doctors because the United States creates a brain drain in these countries, and their doctors who usually study in Europe or America tend to travel to the U.S. with hopes of finding jobs because it would pay more than if they went home. So Cuba's created this army of doctors that are serving the health care of the population of the rest of the world. And it can be seen in the fact that when the earthquake occurred, Cuba did not have to rush doctors into Haiti because Cuban doctors were already in Haiti servicing the people in the countries, in the community. And not only were they already there, but Cuba sent more. So this is the dilemma that Cuba has. The services that Cuba provide to the world for free is the services that the United States sell to the world, and not only that, impose on the world that they should buy it by use of their armed forces. And that is a bad example. So that is the crux of the problem today. And I thank NETFA, great job explaining what the Cuban Five were and why they existed and why we should try to fight to ensure that they are freed from these draconian sentences in the United States that for crimes that they're not guilty of.
Okay, that is it's true, Brother Van Bushy, and we'd like to add another piece to the story of how did we get to this point of the incarceration of the Cuban Five. And to talk about that particular point, we'd like to bring in Brother Haki and raise the issue with Brother Haki based upon his understanding of the Cuban Five case. What was the backdrop of the historical behavior of the U.S. government as relates to the ongoing trial aspect of the Cuban Five? Can you speak to the backdrop of the behavior of the U.S. government and their so-called indictment or being accused of being espionage, led to be accused of being espionage against the state of the U.S.? What has been the history and the behavior of the U.S. government as relates to the whole trial process that the Cuban Five had to go through?
Yes, well, actually, the kind of injustice that was administered, you know, by the state, and particularly the prosecutors down there in Miami, is pretty indicative of the kind of behavior that always manifests itself in terms of being unjust. Even in the context of America, when you look at historically at African-American political prisoners, if you look at the situation confronted Sekou Odinga or Mutulu Shakur, the same kind of shenanigans played themselves out in terms of the kind of duplicity that took place with respect to these judicial officials. Now, one of the things that was very interesting in terms of the Cuban Five case was the whole question in terms of, you know, first and foremost, you know, the charges that was allocated against a couple of dozen in particular. Now, the brother Geraldo Hernandez case was very, very interesting because the whole notion was that, in fact, he was charged with conspiracy. Now, of course, anybody who understands anything about U.S. law, then you understand conspiracy is a very, very general kind of broad kind of catch-all kind of policy. And essentially what it is that we have no information in terms of being able to convict you, but we charge you generally so we can pretty much pick information up as we go along and hope that something sticks. So that's essentially what conspiracy is. But his particular case had a lot to do in terms of a situation in which there was an organization down in Miami called Brothers to the Rescue. It was headed by this notorious terrorist named Basalto. Okay. His role was in terms of to provoke Cuba into, you know, creating some type of act that would justify U.S. intervention in terms of, you know, confronting Cuba with some alleged injustice. In this particular case, what they wanted to do was, by virtue of violating Cuba airspace, him and his people were flying, violating Cuba airspace in the hope that Cuba would be provoked and therefore justifying the U.S. in terms of military intervention. Now, having done this on two previous occasions, he was comfortable, according to sources in Miami, that he could actually continue to do this and get away with this. In fact, one of the things he went on television and talked about, he was talking about the fact that, in fact, Cuba is a paper tiger. It's nothing they can do. You can violate the airspace. They don't have the means to respond. You can do pretty much anything you want to do. So apparently he convinced two other Cessna planes to, in fact, believe that. And in the process of flying and violating Cuba airspace, the Cubans responded and shot down two of the planes. Now, keep in mind, you know, prior to this incident, Cuba was in continuous conversation with the U.S. government in terms of, you know, violating their airspace and please to tell them stop doing it because of the possible implications. But of course, the U.S. government didn't know exactly, they knew exactly what was going on, so they've been taking this particular care. Now, during this particular incident, what happened was that these guys, the professor and the rest of his crew, the Brothers to the Rescue, was notified not only by the Cuban authorities in terms of violating the space, but also by the U.S. FAA, Federal Administration. They were also notified by them in terms of the violations that were taking place. And he disregarded that and continued to do it. And as a consequence, the Cuban government responded and they shot him down. Of course, something had to figure out a way in terms of getting back at him. I mean, this sort of intervention is not that simple when it comes to Cuba, but Cuba is so well organized and people are so disciplined that just simply to take on their military is
not cut and dry. It's not like going into Iraq somewhere where you can essentially, you know, have your way.
It's really a different ballgame. So if you intervene in military in Cuba, you actually be there for a while, and you're responding to that. But given the overall malaise of the U.S. economy, you're not in a position to do that. So
that reason, they found other ways in terms of getting back at the Cubans. And one of the ways they got back to Cuba was to solve the Cuban fire.
In particular, we talk about the other Geraldo Hernandez.
They, in fact, charged him conspiracy in the sense that he played a part in terms of the downing of those Cessnas over Cuban airspace.
Of course, that could not be demonstrated, but whether or not to be demonstrated was the issue that we had to get in the suffering. And the whole thing that was not a single file out of 2,000 pages of information that the government supposedly accumulated, not a single piece of evidence pointed to his guilt in terms of being an accessory to figure that was plain. But that wasn't the issue. The issue was that we just wanted to send a message to Cuba, you know, chicks attack, you know, you shot down the plane, so therefore, you know, we come at you. And so that's what that was all about. Now, in addition to that, it was very interesting, as one of the things is that they also, you know, went into the brother's home, went into his computer, and confiscated a lot of information. Now, if that wasn't bad enough, I mean, I do understand that because of the changes in the laws, because the laws have become more repressive, in fact, there are laws to justify that kind of criminal activity by the government when they deem it as a real threat in the process. So, therefore, they're justified in terms of, you know, breaking people's homes and stealing information. But the interesting thing is that what they did in terms of preventing people having access to the information, like normally when you talk about criminal trials, you talk about discovery phase in which what happens is that the defense gets the opportunity to look at all the information that the prosecution have in terms of, you know, presenting against their client so they can present a case, you know, to represent their client. But what they did in this particular case, they stamped it top secret. And because of stamping it top secret, it means that the defense or the Cuban side or this brother in particular didn't have access to the information that the state had in terms of, you know, mounting a viable defense, you know, for the brothers. So that's the second thing they do. And now keep in mind, this is not unusual when we talk about this kind of duplicity when it comes to U.S. government. Like I alluded to before, in terms of African American political prisoners, it's the same ballgame. They employ some of the same tactics. So it's clearly indicative of just how repressive, oppressive the society has become
and a need to be concerned about what's taking place. Now, with respect to the brother Antonio Guerrero, the whole notion was that supposedly he violated the Southern Command down in Miami in terms of having access to valuable information in terms of U.S. intelligence and defense and stuff and so on. Now, the brother worked at an airport in which he had no clearance. He had no access to high information. He had no access whatsoever. But it didn't stop them from charging him with conspiracy in terms of, you know, violating the integrity or the secrets of the state, which is completely bogus. Again, that is something to substantiate the allegation that, in fact, that the brother had any kind of information between the U.S. defense or intelligence secrets. So again, it was just a situation with the U.S. wanting some means to getting back at Cuba, which seems to happen to the brother to the rescue. Now, the whole thing in terms of when you talk about or trials, a certain kind of decorum you have to maintain, if in fact you're concerned about justice. And one of the things that when you present a certain argument, you want to begin it in such a way that it's not prejudicial, or that it somehow it makes the person look guilty without actually having the evidence to prove, in fact, the person is in fact guilty. So this prosecutor has been speaking a lot of very prejudicial statements in terms of alluding to, you know, the fact that they're attracted to the United States. Talking about the fact that this brother is somehow, if we don't deal with him, then you know, he has set an example for others to emulate and all this kind of very prejudicial kinds of stuff that they were espousing. Now, you would think that in those circumstances that the judge would say, wait a minute, you know, these statements are prejudicial, you know, on their grounds, so they don't actually be stupid in terms of the case. But that isn't the case. But this particular judge, I mean, Joan Lennett, she was very, very right wing. In fact, one of the things that was very clear that came out in the course of the trial was that she viewed the trial as a stepping stone. She realized that under all circumstances, these brothers must be convicted because of always Christians in terms of moving up the judicial scale. So she has aspirations in terms of being in a higher court window, and she realized that. So these are the kind of things that took place in terms of future God, and it speaks to, our discussion in terms of does justice really exist in America. I think most people are somewhat unclear in terms of whether or not justice really exists. But I think for a thousand of the people, they're really beginning to understand the nature of the beast in terms of, in fact, given the economic layers that covers the society, that justice, the two things today could never be a reality because in order for that to be, then there's no way the system could stand in fact that it's just. Or that justice is
rendered to people who are charged with crime. In America, we look at a situation where you have 2.3 million people who are currently incarcerated. Over 5 million people, either under auspices of the criminal justice system, either the parole or probation. Clearly, there is a problem in terms of the system's ability in terms of rendering justice. And I think the Cuban Five is a very prime example in terms of, you know, the extent to which they will go in terms of maintaining the system. And after all, this is what it's all about. It's really about maintaining the system. It has nothing to do with justice. And so I hope that, that more and more people do get involved in terms of rendering a real injustice and bringing these brothers home so they can leave their families and the kids of their countries. And as Brother Lee said earlier, these brothers are real heroes.
Okay. We'd like to raise this question with Brother Detville, and we'd like to let our listening audience know that if you're having some difficulties in terms of listening, in terms of hearing the presentations and the information, there are some technological problems that we are encountering that is out of our control. We just ask you to stay patient with us, bear with us, and we'll continue to try to work through that. But it's the kind of technology where we don't control when, from time to time, when you're doing the nature of these type of programs, it happens. So bear with us. Brother Medford, one of the crucial issues in terms of this whole process and this trial thing, particularly at the beginning of the trial, there was a request for a change of venue to move it out of Miami. What were some of the additional contradictions that the Cuban 5 has to face as relates to presenting a fair just case on these allegations? What was the role of the media? What is the role of this whole climate in Miami? What are some of the contradictions that existed in this case that the public need to know? Why this was just an outrageous and unjust case against the 5?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the main things that's particularly in relationship to the media is that the United States government has actually been exposed as having paid journalists to create the atmosphere of contempt for the 5. So there are stories being planted in print and TV and radio that didn't bring about the truth, but actually just fostered animosity and slanted stories and sensationalized them and just created unwarranted contempt for them. And so that's something serious that's completely against the ethics of journalism. So anybody who's supposed to be in journalism is supposed to just try to report the truth. But in this instance, you see the state actually using the media as a propaganda tool in this sense, because it was against the interest of the status quo to tell the truth. Other things, there were jurors that were intimidated. You know, a lot of people don't realize is that the exile community, the Miami Cuban exile community, the extremists, the leafy, this old guard, the spin and control stuff, is actually organized crimes. They're actually the mafia in Cuba. And it's not just the term we give to them. That's what they are, you know. That's who they are. And so they are very threatening. They're intimidating. They will. People have been killed, like Mambosi Ray. They've been, you know, attempted to assassinate many people in the United States and in Cuba and other places. Not just attempted, have even succeeded. And so they have ways of reaching people, like in the jurors of the trial. Some have since come out and said that they have been approached and were intimidated to rule in any other way than what they thought was fair. They felt intimidated to rule in what they thought was fair, but the rule what they thought was safeguard their life, I guess, and what they were supposed to rule according to other people. And so those kind of things are gross improprieties when it comes to a judicial system and getting a fair trial. The media, the jury intimidation, those are the main two things that I can think of to answer your question.
Okay, and for Brother Bamboshi, when we look at this case, we realize the whole purpose of the 5 penetrating inside the U.S., we say if we're to help stop terrorism. We understand that the U.S. is supposed to be on record that they're supposed to be against terrorism. But this is clearly on the side of the terrorists. Now, can you talk about Bam Bush just a little bit about some of the terrorist acts that Cuba and other countries had to face? What have you faced even up to today that's coming out of Miami, and who are some of these players that are still orchestrating the acts for the shore of the United States?
Thank you for raising that one, because terrorism is not an act of a military force going up against another military force. Instead, it's the act of an organized military force going up against the civilian population of a country in attempts to scare them into surrendering or to scare them into doing some political act that they have refused to do politically. So when the United States talk about terrorism, they talk about the fact that people came into the United States and attacked the civilian population of the United States. Now, any normal person can see many contradictions with this, because the United States itself goes into many countries and attacks the civilian population of those countries. But nevertheless, they've made a special effort to do it in Cuba. And this effort, again, has been ongoing since the 1960s. And the objective of this effort is to get the Cuban population to turn against its government and overthrow its government because its government not giving in to pressure from the United States has caused such a hardship on the civilian population. This has not happened. And I would dare say that this probably will never happen. However, in terms of terrorist acts against Cuba, you have a man who now lives in Miami, old man. He was much younger, but he was one of the chief terrorists in the world. He lives today freely in Miami, walks the street daily. He's actually seen as a hero in Miami. But you yourself should judge. What kind of hero blows up a civilian airliner, killing 72 people, including a whole Cuban fencing team, for the sole reason that it's a Cuban plane? What kind of hero would go to Mexico, where Fidel Castro is about to speak to an audience full of high school kids, and try to assassinate them and to blow up the auditorium, killing all the kids that's in the auditorium? For anybody with any logical sense, does that sound like a hero to you? This is the nature of these fascist groups in Miami who contend that they are Cuban liberation strugglers. But in reality, they are allied with the CIA, and the CIA's and U.S. government's objective to overthrow the Cuban government, and that's all. And they're getting paid by the CIA for doing what they do. So when Bush, the last Bush, came out and said that in terms of terrorism, either you are with us or you're with the terrorists, I'm not sure how he interprets that contradiction when he's with the terrorists in Miami. Because obviously the terrorists in Miami is not with the American people. So I'm glad that you raised that question, Mitzvah. And I would probably like to add another question for you. And I think, I don't know, somebody else might be able to do more justice to this question than I could. But the question is that Rene Gonzalez, Fernando Gonzalez, and Geraldo Hernandez were all involved in a particular struggle that's close to our heart as black people. They were part of a group of Cubans who went into Angola to help defend Angola's independence. And as such, the victory that the Angolan government had in that struggle against particularly the South African government, but again, the South African government, financed and supplied by both Israel and the United States, that victory allowed for the independence of Angola, for Angola to have its own self-determination to continue with the independence that they had validly fought for and gained from Portugal, but it also allowed for the independence of Southwest Africa, which is today Namibia, from the South African government. And it allowed, ultimately, for the defeat of the apartheid regime in South Africa. This victory against the South African military shook them so much that they saw the end. They saw the end coming. At least it took two more years, but today, on paper, South Africa is independent. Namibia is independent, and Angola is independent, and we have to thank the Cubans, but even more than that, we have to thank three of these five men who are in jail, who were in jail. And for that reason, we would say we as a people owe the Cuban Five, and we have to ensure that all the Cuban Five are freed. But I would like to hear my brothers speak a little bit more about the role of these members of the Cuban Five in our struggle in Angola, because this is our interest, and this is how we're connected particularly, even though out of the need for universal justice we're connected, period, even if they did not fight in Angola, we must be for justice.
Okay, let me start with Brother Haki. Would you like to take a stand to the sole response of our brothers who went to Angola, to Road 84, and how it's connected to, I guess, to raise the interest why a particular African community should have invested interest in terms of making sure we make our contribution to help see our brothers and sisters of the Cuban Five?
Well, you know, I think they are, you know, their heroic actions says a lot in terms of the human spirit. It says a lot in terms of the kind of system that would produce individuals who are so selfless, who are willing to actually, you know, potentially give up their lives for the good, for a noble good. So it speaks volumes in terms of what kind of people these are and what kind of system they come from. Now, when you contrast that with a system in terms of coming out of America, which we're taught essentially to debase life, where we're taught that nothing matters but self, where we're taught that justice is really an arbitrary term, and that is, you know, we use justice based upon our needs, and so there's no clear hard and fast rule when we talk about justice in the context of the American system. So when you look at individuals like the Cuban Five who are willing to go to Angola and participate in the struggle to assist those brothers in terms of their liberation, I mean, you got to take your hats off to them. I mean, and then when you think at a situation where you got a guy like you know, Jonas Savimbi and his UNITA organization in terms of his willingness to go to any extreme in terms of, you know, maintaining control, I mean, gaining control of that country. We're talking about, you know, putting down, an enormous amount of mines, you know, sprayed out throughout the country, you know, blowing up innocent people for no reason whatsoever, simply because this guy's in the pursuit of power. Now, is it a coincidence that he was supported by the U.S. government and South African government? Not at all. History suggests that whenever people are ruthless, greedy, selfish, unprincipled, then they tend to be backed by the United States of America. Now, does that say something in terms of the kind of system or the kind of system and kind of the values that it inculcates into the minds of people? So clearly, I think the real threat in terms of them brothers actually being over there is to demonstrate, you know, that this whole notion in terms of the value of humanity is so, so important. And I think that is the thing that fundamentally scares people, you know, in the United States, particularly the power structure. I think once they realize that, as the people in this country become realized, you know, that the pursuit of human dignity is more important than any amount of money, then the system is over. And so, therefore, these guys represent something that was very real to the power structure, and so, therefore, you know, they constitute a real threat. Now, just in terms of, you know, that when they went over there, I mean, it wasn't a thing where they were commanded to go over there. These brothers took upon themselves and said, listen, I want to go over to Angola to assist those brothers in their fight. They volunteered to go over there. Now, I'm just wondering, has there ever been a situation in the history of the United States where American citizens have volunteered to go somewhere to fight, to liberate a people? If there is one, maybe the other brothers can clarify, because I can't think of one offhand. So these brothers are truly exceptional in terms of, you know, in terms of their commitment to humanity, in terms of selfishness. So I think
And I think that I'm not going to say that the Angolans wouldn't have succeeded without the brothers' help from Cuba, but I think Cubans played a big part in terms of inspiring others who are part of the Angolan army and as well as throughout the southern region of Africa, to actually take on these very powerful adversaries like the U.S. and South Africa. So I think that the answer to brother's question is that we really can never pay these brothers back for what they've done for Africa. We can at the very minimum advocate who struggle on their behalf in terms of getting them out of prison. But can we truly repay them? Probably not, because what they did was just really off the charts. I mean, most people don't arbitrarily volunteer to potentially give up their lives. That's just the cold reality. So when you find brothers like that, these brothers are exceptional, and so you owe them a great debt. So all that I can say is that these brothers will go down in history and to set as an example for inspiration to others throughout the world who understand the value of human life and being willing to die for it.
And we would like to go to our brother Neffel. Your response to that, brother Neffel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I think Brother Bembosi and Brother Haki said it's actually hard to add anything to any of that. But one of the things I'd like to I think one of the points that Brother Haki makes about we said that they volunteered to go, and I think people should be given clarity so they really understand what this is about. It's not like the people who went, the individual people who joined the military United States during World War One or whatever, who volunteered. This is not what we're talking about. We're talking about the state having to be convinced by the people who felt that connection to Africa to say, we need to go there and help them, and we will volunteer to be part of the force that does it. I mean, so that needs to be clear, because that's what makes it so unprecedented. And so, you had that Brothers of Africans and whoever saying to the Cuban state, their leadership, especially after Angola's ass. I mean, the connection to Cuba and African liberation is also broader than Angola and the frontline states. And, people should just know that. I know we all know this, but, it goes into, Guinea-Bissau and the Congo and so... in Algeria. I mean, there's a strong relationship between revolutionary Cuba and its assistance for us in our independence struggles against colonialism. And then also in the United States and other, particularly in the United States, Africans here, we have Sister Sata who has asylum there. They've given asylum to other of our freedom fighters that didn't have any place to go after the assault by the FBI and CIA came upon them, and they were right here in the belly of the beast fighting and having to go somewhere, to go underground. And so it's a strong and very unprecedented relationship. And so, and there's another point, because this speaks to how grateful we should be and how we owe to do something for the freedom of the Cuban Five, which is all that seems to be asked of us here that reside in the United States from the Cuban people. At least help us free our heroes. There's nothing else that Cuba has ever, and even they don't demand it now, they're just requesting it. But the other thing about them, so it behooves us to join that. But the other thing that was deep about what Brother Haki meant is also the fact that the fact that people can be this selfless in a world that really kind of tries to orientate us to be the opposite means that it gives us hope about the possibility of a different world that's ordered on other things. What are the essential principles of socialism? What are the essential principles and values that individuals should have that have us in this transition from this state, the world dominated by imperialism and neocolonialism and all that, for us to carry out our work to changing it? What should a nation look like? What should it be? What kind of way should it play itself in the world? Cuba's sending doctors all over and teachers everywhere now, and actually with a mandate of non-interference. I don't know if people understand when they go, the doctors that go and they go to an orientation, teachers or whatever, they have what they call the prime directive is we can't interfere in the political affairs. So they don't go in there like the United States. I mean, it's just, can we have doctors. You need doctors, we'll give you doctors. They're not asking for any kind of political advantage or you know. And they might, you know, work something. I mean, obviously, all nations, all groups, you know, work each other out with leadership and stuff like that. But it's a very selfless and internationalist spirit. It's very genuine, the principles that has a lot to teach the world. And again, like Brother Hakim and even Bambo, you were mentioning, we're actually also explaining why it's such a threat, why this little island, you know, the island 90 miles off the coast with the biggest power in the world, the most, you know, physical power in the world, is looked at so, you know, why they can't just let Cuba be. Because its strength is in more than it's in so much more than its material advantages and exchanges in the world, its interactions. Its strength is in the power of the ideas that it kind of puts out. Which of course, the power of the ideas is all there so that they're doing things in action practically. You know, if we believe that healthcare is a right of all human beings, how do we actually create that system that provides it in spite of that? And so not only do they talk about it, then they actually make it, not just within their country, but in other places around the world. And so it's a very, that example in terms of how to be theory and practice, in terms of revolutionary theory and practice in the world, we have to take our hats off to them.
You know, I was going in one direction, but based upon what has just been articulated by all three of y'all, I'd like to just, you know, just raise this fundamental question when we talk about this particular case. Clearly to us, you know, this case is very political. And when you look at what's going on inside of the United States with the political movement in the United States, a lot of people seem to suggest it should be linked with the political movement inside of the United States. And there are positive and negative considerations that you have to give to that issue. How do y'all view this case in terms of the context of being a case as a means of political prisoners? Brother Bamboshi, how would you respond to that?
Hello?
Yes, Brother Bamboshi. The question was, how do you respond to many people believe that this case should be linked up to the political movement, political prison movement inside the United States? And there's a pros and cons to that argument. How do you see that?
Oh, I agree. It's part and parcel of the struggle to free all political prisoners in the United States and to free all prisoners of war in the United States and outside the United States. I think that definitely it's part of that struggle. It's only separated from that struggle in that it's a particular injustice that has been dealt upon a country because of who the country is and because of who the people is. Historically, there's no other place in the world where a country and a government has said an airplane invades our territory. We told it it's in our territory to leave. It flies over the national territory and drops leaflets just as well as it could have dropped bombs. This plane was not shot down by an individual. It was shot down by the Cuban government. And the people who were in the plane, because of how flimsy the plane was in particular, died. I don't think any of them died from shots from the Cuban aircrafts that shot them down. I think they died when it crashed into the sea. But it was over Havana. It was over a densely populated area, and it was dropping unknown items. And to show you how significant this is, there was, you know, in terms of dropping stuff from a plane that is obviously antagonistic to the Cuban government, if that had happened inside the United States, the plane would have been shot down. Would they then say that whoever the person was running the radar that first spotted the plane is guilty of murder because the people who were in the plane got killed? This is what has happened in terms of the Cuban case. In terms of the Cuban case, you have one man who is serving two life sentences plus 15 years, which is a sentence that probably could or could not be carried out. Supposedly, if it ran concurrently, it would equal to one life sentence. But nevertheless, it's a ridiculous sentence. It's a sentence that no other country has waged against a particular individual from any other country. Nowhere have anybody said, we capture a pilot in Vietnam who was bombing the civilian population, and we're going to charge him with murder. They said he's a part of the United States Air Force. And if there's anybody guilty of murder, it's the United States and its Air Force. So here you have a total miscarriage of justice. And I'm just giving you this example because there are a number of other examples. Just 2 months ago, some little kids from the environmental movement went into one of the large oil companies in Oklahoma City and unfurled a banner that said, no Keystone Pipeline. Now, on this banner, they had glitter. They little kids, they like to dress up their banners. But the glitter fell off the banner onto the ground inside of the Devon Oil Company, and the FBI swept the stuff up, took it away, and immediately charged them with terrorism, saying that the stuff could have been chemicals that could have killed people. Now, be serious. They walked into the building with the banner. But this is the way that the United States play with the law today. The law means not what it means, but whatever the United States chooses to mean. So here you have this overshadowing chaos and confusion, no objectivity in terms of the application of the law. And I'm sure it's history to that. I'm sure our Native American brothers and so on could tell you about the history. Definitely our brothers and sisters in Haiti, where the United States invaded and seized their treasury and took it to the Rockefeller Bank in New York, can tell you about that history. So I think that there is bad precedents for most of this.
Okay. In terms of this whole issue of when we look at the Cuban Five, one of the things this government takes pride in terms of trying to project to the world is that it's a democracy. It has openness. It has fairness. I'd like to just raise this question with Brother Haki as it relates to the media. We know that in this country, there has basically been a blackout on this case since its existence. But more in particular, we know that we so-called have a freedom of a press that exists in this country, which states that the press is free to really articulate and talk about any kind of issues that is important to the public. Now, I'd like to talk more particularly about the African press inside of the United States. Could you give me your perspective why there has not been very little or any coverage on the Cuban Five as relates to the African press? What is the condition and climate that is causing the press to not to be responsible in terms of when we talk issues that is important to the interests of people in general, and particularly African people in particular?
Well, you can't have a realistic discussion about the media without understanding its connection to the capitalist system. One of the things historically, when you look at the media in terms of the number of organizations that actually exist, it's quite a bit more than currently exists. Currently, we're talking about 6 organizations that affect control what you see and what you read. And so what happens is that's an odd amount of power or control for a very select, very small number of people who determine what the news would be and how the news would be conveyed to people who consume it. So we have to understand that there's a reason for the consolidation in terms of news. It has nothing to do in terms of saving money. It has to do with power. In other words, the fewer the people who are actually in position to control news, then the more you can control news content. So this is what we have to understand. So now, in terms of when you talk about democracy, one of the things that we're very clear on is that, you know, democracy is a very funny term. In the context of America, democracy is often used as a concept. Now, of course, being a concept, then you can pretty much define democracy any way you want. Now, when Democrats talk about the importance of democracy, what he was talking about, the small number of people of any society have the right to run the society for their benefit. That, in fact, for him was democracy. And if you think about concept, it makes perfect sense that politicians will receive democracy in that light, whereas the mass of people may believe that, in fact, democracy is all-encompassing in some type of egalitarianism, and it's not. Now, if you talk about democracy in the context of principle, that's a different ballgame. See, principle means that, in fact, democracy is egalitarianistic, which means that the greatest good for the greatest number of people. So, therefore, if the masses of people want housing, then it becomes priority. If the masses of the people want quality education, it becomes priority. If the masses of people want access to affordable homes, affordable shelter, or homes, or houses, then it becomes possible. So this is quite different. So this democracy that they practice is quite different than what people think the democracy should be. Now back to the issue in terms of the media. One of the things is that there was a famous journalist who critiqued George Bush during his time in office, and the notion that the question around wasn't that George Bush evaded military services. Now in this famous journey person, you know, he was on TV for over 20 years. Well, he didn't last long after he questioned George's history in terms of, you know, evading military service, because it didn't project the kind of image that America, the powerful, want to project in terms of its leadership. And so, therefore, even though he's been on the air for a long, long time, they let him go. So we understand that this control in terms of the media, you know, it doesn't bode well in terms of being able to actually talk about those things to cast the society in a very negative light. And I superimpose upon that one of the very strange things in terms of, you know, media generally. Anytime there's a system which is based upon, you know, advertisements or corporate dollars for your existence, then that by itself means that the position that you advocate is compromised to a great extent. And so, therefore, if the medical establishment is doing things that are counterproductive, if they're doing procedures which people don't need in terms of making money, it's not likely that you're going to talk about that if, in fact, you get lots of dollars from American Medical Association and people that are in that vein. So we have to understand that to a large extent that the media, that the information that we receive is compromised, and so therefore they cannot convey certain messages. Now, with respect to the Cuban Five, one thing, when you talk about the Cuban Five, you talk about this question in terms of political prisoners. Now, even in the context of America, how often do we talk about people like Segu Odinga? How often do we talk about that, or Petula Shakur, or Sumi Adekoli, or Siri Berardini? How often do we even talk about the 217 political prisoners in this country? How often do we even talk about that? How many of us even realize that America has more political prisoners than any country on the planet? How often do we talk about that? We can't. They're not going to allow those kind of discussions to take place. In fact, every time there's programs that we're privy to, that the kind of people who are on those programs are vetted. So therefore, they have people who got a vested interest in maintaining the lie, because if they didn't maintain the lie, then they lose their job, or they lose their sponsorship, or they lose something on some level. And so therefore, people like you and I and brothers of Nefer and brother Bamboshi, they would never put on national television and have a discussion around issues that are pertinent to people in this country. It just doesn't happen. So the issue of democracy, but back to the issue of democracy, I think one thing is we have to understand that if we're sincere about democracy, then what we should have, what we would have, is something very similar to what's going on in Cuba in terms of democracy. Cuba is much more democratic in the sense that, you know, when you talk about organization community, you have community-based organizations, the Center for the CDRs, what is it, Community for Defense of Revolution, you know, who actually deal with a lot of these issues that pertain to the people and being able to present that information to higher-ups, which the discussions take place and which you create policy. Quite different in America, in which essentially, you know, we quote-unquote, we vote for our representatives, big off the power, and that's the end of that. So we have no voice whatsoever. So the only time these guys actually do anything is when they're the recipient of some type of dollar from some major corporation. But when we articulate our needs, then it's not important because we don't have access to money, we can't give them money, and so therefore what we have to say is not important. So issues like housing, shelter housing, food, decent education, those jobs, those things never get addressed. So I think that in the current context, in terms of the way the system is set up, and because of the deteriorating capitalist system, there's no way in the world you're going to have a legitimate democracy in the sense that it gives a damn about the masses of people in society, or be in a position to actually, you know, do something in terms of those needs of the people that depend on them in terms of getting their needs addressed.
Okay, we'd like to alert our listening audience that in 3 minutes we're going to be opening up our phone lines, and those who's on the line who wait to get their views or comment, if they can just hold on about 2-3 more minutes, so we'll come directly to you. But before we do that, we'd like to just inform you that we are discussing the Cuban Five today, its implications and its relevance to the African community in particular. And with us, we have Brother Bam Boshi from the National Network on Cuba and the All African People Revolutionary Party, GC. We just heard Brother Haki Kamafi Machoki with the African Women's Association, and we have with us Brother Nefer Freeman with the International Committee for the Freedom of the Cuban Five. Brother Nefer, before we go to our callers, again, we invite our callers to call in at 323-679-0841. And if you have a comment or a question, please make sure you hit 1 so we can acknowledge you. We'll call out the last 4 digits of your phone number. Hit number 1 if you have a comment or a question that you'd like to ask. But Brother Neffel, in terms of your organization, the Committee to Free the Five, what kind of difficulties have y'all encountered in terms of trying to publicize and really educate the community, the mass community, about this whole issue of the Cuban Five? Can you just discuss some of the realities that y'all had to deal with, or the realities that you are dealing with in terms of this question of propaganda and trying to inform and educate the public on the Five?
Right. Well, one of the things that we deal with is that we don't get invited to radio shows to talk extensively and be allowed to just completely or even any kind of, you know, capitalist corporate media, as Brother Aki said. So we have to, but still it still means we have to do the work. We have to put out a broad net, a wide net. So in other words, you put a press release out, you don't avoid NBC, you know, but at the same time, you know, you don't expect anything from it. And so that's the kind of thing. So we actually have to make close relationships. And also, you know, how much is it? It's really about building a broad-based movement to do this. And so we have to first start where the communications, the media's means of communication that are grassroots. And so to build that, because that's really where the strength will come from for it to really make a difference. And then trying to do things that are compelling enough to make people see. I know that one of the things in terms of people's ideas and perceptions is that in the African community, people might have a tendency not to see Cuba as African, you know, as part of the African diaspora or you know, yeah, of African people or being black, you know, and which is a mistake in terms of when we look at the, you know, demographics. And also how we've just been talking about the relationship, the more concrete relationship, and not just seeing as white. We can look at the Cuban Five and most people see 5 white men. This is different than what we usually expect when we're looking at our political prisoner situation here in the United States, those who are conscious enough to look at political prisoners. And so we have to get over a psychological thing that's, you know, just conditioning that have to do with, you know, assuming certain things, you know, based on phenotype, and realize, you know, okay, yeah, I mean, Cuba's mostly African, and then you might, the Cuban Five couldn't be anything, do what they were doing, but be anything but a white-looking Cuban, because that's what the right in Miami, Mafia is, so you're not going to send Africans over there for that. But people don't really understand and see Cuba as part of Africa, so that's another, I guess you could see, propaganda thing, because even when you see the media, it doesn't really show the Africanness of Cuba, I mean, it doesn't really show much of Cuba, period, at all. And so, you know, we can only go by, you know, the connotations that, and so that's something we have to fight for in terms of the ideas and the media that we use, and looking at social media, and also forging connections, because there are issues related to race and the evolution history of race that affect the interaction between the two people. So we have to, in other words, how people see you. So, for instance, I'm seeing, and this is a progressive thing, a much more respect, a really newly developed respect by, particularly it starts with the Cuban Five and the Cuban people for the political prisoners here. The Cuban Five have been in prison since like 1998, but it's not really until now that we see emerging a public acknowledgement that this is, you know, a shared struggle. The Cuban Five just issued an open letter to Lynn Stewart and Mumia, you know, and just talking about, you know, that they're, you know, respecting them and all political prisoners. I had to actually the fortunate opportunity to go to Cuba just last November to the colloquium in Holguín about the Cuban Five, and when I was able to interview Rene Gonzalez, and he talked about it, and he mentioned it. I didn't have to ask him. I mean, I think I did ask him about a little, you know, I did ask him a point of question, but still, it was something he elaborated on more, and you could tell he was already feeling something about it. He praised Mumia, he talked about it, and he actually said that we, you know, the people of the United States have an obligation to support their political prisoners. You know, and he mentioned why, you know, they are getting the worst treatment because of what they stand up for. You know, it's like when you stand for something, you're going to get the worst. You know, he even praised he talked about mass incarceration. And I mean, and so the thing is, we're seeing, and these are, you know, we should be embracing these developments, but we should also be cognizant that our enemies will see them as a threat.
Okay, we can go to that phone line. Again, for callers who have something to say, please make sure you call 323-679-0841 and punch 1. You must punch in 1 so you can let us know that you would like to have a question or comment. We're going to one of our first callers, caller number 4298, caller number 4298. Welcome to Africa on Your Move. Your question or comment, please, caller.
Yes, this is Brother Robert A. Moses. It's such an honor to be on a program with such a distinguished panel. You have an all-star panel there.
We thank you, Carlo. Your question or comment, please.
Well, I think that, you know, it should be pointed out that two of the, I'm not sure the names, but two of the Cuban Five actually fought with the Angolan people in order to liberate and break the backs of the South African army, which led to the release of Nelson Mandela, and that it should be recognized that two of them actually were with that army.
Okay, I think it was acknowledged earlier, if I'm not mistaken, by Brother Bamboshi, but I think it's a point that needs to be emphasized, particularly when you live in a society where race is a major factor of how people view things. And one of the things I often say to the community when it comes to Cuban Five, that, you know, we can't always judge things by the physical looks or appearance or something, the biology or something. And yes, with three of the brothers, that volunteered to go into to go to Africa, help fight side by side for our brothers. So, as they mentioned earlier, we owe many debts to Cuba, and this is just one of them. Yes, brother, we thank you for your comment and continue to support Africa on the move. We next would like to go to caller 2872. Question or comment, please? Caller 2872. Question or comment, please?
Peace and blessings, brothers. No, I don't have a question. I'm listening and learning, and probably later on in the show I'll have some questions. But right now I'm just listening and learning.
Okay, Carl, thank you. Continue listening. If you have any kind of question, or want to make a statement, feel free to always hit number one, and we'll bring you back in. We'd like to thank you. Do we have Carlo 1116? Question or comment from Carlo 1116? Any question or comment, please? Carlo 1116. Okay, I guess 1116 don't have any questions right now. They'll continue to listen. So we'll go back to Brother Bamboshi. We would like for you, Brother Bamboshi, one of the things I think is important that we need to talk about around this whole case of the Cuban Five is this whole question, and you alluded to earlier in terms of talking about some of the history, really the connectedness of Cuba in terms of as a country, in terms of its foreign policy. And how its foreign policy has played out and benefit particular people of color and particular African people. Can you just talk a little bit more about that? Because what it does is it shows you the type of society that people can take a look at and learn a lot of things from in terms of transforming human beings to be better human beings. I think that was one of the points Brother Haki alluded to earlier. But in terms of the Cuban foreign policy, how does it mix or match in terms of when you look at the Cuban foreign policy as it relates to Africa, African people, and the U.S. foreign policy as it relates to Africa, African people?
I think that both Brother Haki and Brother Netfa have spoken about this, but that, you know, again, Cuba is a majority African country, and as such, it has a closer relationship to the people who are in Africa and the people who are in Northern, Central and South America and the Caribbean, and also to Asia, than it has to most everybody else. And I think that this is part and parcel of the factor of Cuba's population and Cuba's practice of democracy, especially participatory democracy, where these decisions are made on from the smallest level up to the highest level. So definitely the people participate directly in the decision-making process. And as such, there was recently a Congress in Cuba, in Havana, where there were over 12,000 issues that were discussed, and they were discussed on every level. And out of that 12,000 issues, something like 11,880 became part of the discussion for implementing as laws. So there is this participatory democracy involved in Cuba, unlike the United States, where, you know, people throw a lot of money to the candidates so that they can buy a lot of radio and TV time, but you really don't know what they're for and what they're against and what they intend to do until they're elected and do it. And then once they're elected, they're only responsible to the people who finance their campaign. And unless you're part of that community that finance their campaign, they have no real responsibility or allegiance to you. So you have this. But even further than that, Cuba and other countries in South and Central America have been slowly building alliances and unions. There is a Bolivarian Union called ALBA, which is countries of South and Central America, who has put together alternatives, specifically alternatives to some of the main institutions in the U.S., such as corporate news. You have ALBA TV, otherwise known as Telesur. You have alternatives to the World Bank and the IMF, which exists in the form of the Bank of the South. And the Bank of the South
is a bank created to give preferential loans to countries for development purposes, but does not extract from them an exorbitant interest that they cannot pay back the loan because they're constantly paying the interest. You have a whole series of medical and educational program that's linked to ALBA that is operating throughout South and Central America and parts of the Caribbean. Today, you have at least five Caribbean countries in ALBA, and possibly more will come. Along with that, there's the community of Caribbean and Latin American states, which is a new formation, which when you look at the population of South and Central American Caribbean, it's possibly that population is at least half the size of the United States population. So you have right under our noses these alliances, which are part and parcel of the Cuban foreign policy and part and parcel of the effect to unite countries who in the past have suffered from dictatorial imperialism that have sent people in, that have used people in countries that are supposedly free as neocolonial agents for United Fruit, for people like that. That is all part of the Cuban foreign policy. But the greatest part of Cuba's foreign policy, I think, is, like its internal policy, is its policy of providing health and education to the world. And given the lifting of the blockade, Cuba is already stationed to become one of the world's greatest producers of medicine, one of the world's greatest exporters of doctors, and it follows their historical course, because historically, in 1958, when the Cuban Revolution came to power, their position was that the revolution in Cuba was for the Cuban children first and the Cuban people. And you can see exactly how this plays out in 1990, when Cuba had to tighten its belt, when they had to cut rations, when they had no gas and people had to either walk or ride bicycles, when, because of the subsidies they were getting from the Soviet Union, who imploded, they were left hanging and had to tighten their belts. However, they are proud even today to say that during this very difficult period for them, they can say that they never closed one hospital and they never closed one school. And it shows where their priority is. Other people have a priority of military spending. They do not. They spend money on life. They spend money on education. And they're waging a struggle of ideas.
Okay. I would like to direct this question to Brother Methel and Haki.
When we're talking about the case of the Cuban Five and this whole question of Cuba, and understanding that there's a Western propaganda war against Cuba and it would create all kind of deception and all kind of ideals that is contrary to the Cuban realities. One of the things that they have done in the West and the United States with the African community and in the United States in general, they try to paint Cuba as being a racist country towards so-called Afro-Cubans inside of Cuba. Now, as it relates to this question around race, what is your take on the reality of Cuba's response in terms of how they dealt with the issues of race and the issue of those Afro-Cubans who live inside of Cuba? Brother Methel, how would you describe that particular struggle, and what are some of the things you think is noteworthy for our people to really understand the real truth as we begin to discuss this question of race inside and outside of Cuba.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a very complicated question when it comes to Cuba, because it, you know, it has a very a unique history that way, and just, yeah, it's complicated. So, it is, you know, we're talking about a revolutionary country that has how many years? 1959 was its revolution, and the history of colonialism and slavery goes back centuries, and so the progress that it could have is not, you know, it has to do with a lot of the world, you know, the world disposition when it comes to things like racism and whatnot. But then, in spite of that, they still have made very, just by establishing a socialist revolution in which everyone is, you know, they're trying to equalize everyone when it comes to material needs. And so that in itself begins, but it doesn't erase everything. So you can't statutorily, you can't legislate racism out of the way. So it's about political education, it's about mentality, you know, people transcending where they are in terms of African people and our inferior complexes we have sometimes, white people and their superiority complexes sometimes, we're just different stereotypes. So a whole, and then how we, those things play out in our day-to-day life. So they're on a struggle, on a path where I think we can learn a lot from them. Because one thing in Cuba you see, it's much more natural, you see more mixed people, and also what people refer here to interracial couples, and so that's more prevalent. It's actually, you know, and particularly if you go to certain places, the country, the Cuba in the beginning of the revolution did set out, and the revolutionary leadership did. Some did say, well, we're not racist, or race is not an issue because we have the socialist revolution, and didn't think about the fact that there was something more complex to racism that still required a struggle and work, a lot of work. And so now the revolution is seriously seeing that, you know, and they're honestly trying to, you know, people are and Fidel for a long time, Fidel Castro for a long time already saw it and was would actually speak about it in meetings and on the media to the Cuban people, you know, admitting and saying that they had things to work on when it came to race issues and how black people were treated, in particular African people, people more of African descent in Cuba. And so now, though, that there's been a lot of open meetings and discussion, there's been, forums, I don't want to say reforms, but forums on things, and they're having to confront some of the ideas they have to deal with that can persist in spite of the fact that things have been equalized. And I think things are equalized in the sense that you do, if you're a person of African, no matter what, you know, race, quote-unquote race you're of, you have access to free education. You have access to free health care. And there might be challenges in terms of the infrastructure of getting those things on equal basis to certain areas and whatnot, but that has much more to do with the isolation of the country, you know, in the world, and the challenges just getting certain things and having to, you know, overcome and evolve to the point where they can unfettered realize their principles and values of the community as a socialist nation, revolutionary nation. But in terms of having, actually doing, you know, doing things to provide the basic human needs, there's no discrimination when it comes to that in Cuba. And so you don't have to, yeah, so, and so that's one thing. But, of course, like every place else, you know, we have to deal with you know, the mentalities of people and understanding of how the intersections of race, the class, and all that there, just like we do here.
And for Brother Haki, what would be your take on this question of race and how the Cubans have dealt with it, from your understanding? Because a lot of times it's been equated as if it's the same phenomena in terms of inside the United States, how U.S. have dealt with Africans inside the United States, and I don't think its history is the same. And, you know, let me just get your understanding from your understanding. How would you characterize that struggle?
I think Brother Neff is right. I think historically the issue of race, of skin color, has been an issue with Cuba. Like any system that seeks to maintain control by a small minority, any divisions that you can utilize is all to the well, all to good for those who, in fact, in power. So we're not denying that historically racism has existed in Cuba, and certainly Fidel Castro recognized that. But one thing I like about Fidel Castro, that one of the things that he talks a lot about, and when he talks about, you know, African blood courses through our veins, I mean, he's very clear in terms of the African blood. In fact, what he's saying is that there is no division among our people, that, in fact, we're one people. And I like what he's saying. Now, concretely, in terms of, you know, just how does that manifest itself? If you, in fact, got an economic system which is seeks to be equitable, in which to share the resources equally and fairly, irrespective of skin color, then these issues, these historical questions in terms of racism, cease to be questions, because over time, all of those misgivings, all this miseducation, all this self-hatred that maybe African people may have been conditioned to believe exists, begin to understand that, you know, it's just a question of conditioning, and only with time will that conditioning become alleviated, you know, by an education system with professed interest and making sure that people see themselves in the highest light. So we have to raise the system in terms of its willingness, in terms of seeing, you know, the unity of human beings. And when we contrast that to America, we look at the situation in terms of race as it exists in America. Now, one of the things that we're very clear on, and when you talk about the origin of human beings, then we understand anthropologically, biologically, historically, scientifically. We understand clearly that the origin of human beings goes right back to Africa. In fact, that we're all African people, in fact, if you want to look at it that way. Now, in order for the system to acknowledge sexuality, would be to undermine the very principles in which it stands on, which is the total marginalization and exploitation of its people via class. And so, therefore, those in America have no interest in terms of teaching American people, in fact, that we're all one people, that your skin color is really esoteric. It really doesn't mean anything at all. It's just color. And historically, if you go back and look at it in terms of why people look different colors, is because of the conditions in which they grew up under. It has nothing. It's not something that has any type of connotation one way or the other in terms of, you know, its existence. So, you know, so we understand that the Cuban system, you know, by virtue of acknowledging the problem that it sort of exists, is in a position now to do something about it. It manifests itself in terms of when you look at the scientists and the engineers, you know, your professional clients in Cuba, a lot of them are very dark, very, very dark. And one of the biggest fears for America is for particular African-American people to realize that this notion in terms of your skin color determining your abilities is really fraudulent. And then once you take a look at Cuba and you see all these dark people doing great things, then it raises the question, inevitably, you know, I thought skin color determines my intellectual capabilities. And then you begin to realize how absurd, how naive this is. But the ruling class understand that they have to continue to push this line in terms of, you know, in terms of skin color, the skin color being determinative in terms of who you are as a human being. So we understand that. Cuba, no question about it. Cuba, no question about it. The question of race in the future will become obsolete. That the Cuban society, we're educated people in terms of the unity of human beings. You know, the situation where in having unity among human beings, that you can do very great things, and that the concern for the less among us is the way to go in terms of building a viable system. A system in America which is built upon division, hatred, it's a system that's untenable. It won't last long. So Cuba has a long future ahead of it, because it's going to deal with the question in terms of race and some of the problems affiliated with race.
Okay, we're going to have a viewer who would like to have a question or comment. We're going to go to our caller now. We're going to call 2252. Caller 2252. Welcome to Africa on Your Move. Your question or comment, please.
How do we deal with exposing the fraudulence and bogusness of people that call us more?
That's an excellent question. Let's go to Brother Bamboshi. How do we deal with that question, Brother Bamboshi?
For people who don't know who Carlos Moore is, Carlos Moore is the African brother who says that his history is that he was in the United States and the Cuban Revolution went down in 1958 and he rushed back to Cuba, and at some point he joined the revolution and became a translator, but he got frustrated because of the amount of racism he saw in the Cuban Revolution, so he came back to the United States and decided to work with some of the more prominent civil rights leaders and people who have been around the civil rights movement in this country, particularly people who are authors. So he has written a couple of books, but from my perspective, his books are extremely dated. They talk about a period of Cuban history that no longer exists. Even though Carlos Moore says that he's been in and out of Cuba several times, especially recently, in the 90s and 2000s, but I'm not sure what Carlos Moore's specific objectives are. I think part of the problem with Carlos, this is my opinion, is that he is probably anti-socialist, and as such, he sees it easier to just blame the issue on racism in Cuba than to really look at the role of capitalism. But I'm sure that other people here have had experiences with Carlos Moore. I've only met him once. I have seen his books, several of his books, and I know historically that many people who are black nationalists per se, quote unquote, have used Carlos as a way of struggling against socialism. However, these same people have never struggled against capitalism. And our major oppressor in this country today is capitalism and racism. And so unless you're also struggling against capitalism and racism, there's no way of eliminating one without the other. There's no way of eliminating racism under capitalism. As a matter of fact, I think Evo Morales probably put it even into a broader and better perspective. He said for Mother Earth to survive, capitalism must die.
Carl, is there another question or comment you'd like to make?
Well, Bambosha, what can we do to expose people like Carlos Moore, because Carlos Moore creates a lot of confusion? Just a few years ago, in a letter that was sent out where he was able to galvanize a lot of support behind those bogus remarks about Cuba, what can we do to counter those? Because a lot of people who seemingly have never traveled to Cuba, they read his remarks, they read his books, and they fall hook, line, and sinker form, and they create a lot of confusion, particularly on the college campuses.
This is true. And here I think we must participate in the struggle that Cuba's called for, a struggle of ideas, because the reality, the truth, is much stronger than the opinions of Carlos Moore or anybody's personal individual opinions, because obviously, there's more than just Carlos Moore. Carlos Moore's last book was financed by the right-wing Cubans in Miami. And they financed that book particularly because they said that it's about time they stand up and accuse Cuba of racism. Well, the fact is that there are also black Cubans in Miami who they oppress, who they have never struggled with for any kind of rights, including civil rights. And the black Cubans in Miami have told them when they stated that, hey, white folks, get real. How do you now want us to come and join you? And you've been the ones oppressing us. So I'm saying that this battle against, and it's not really a battle against Carlos Moore, because, you know, Carlos Moore is easy to dismiss. But it's a battle against backwards ideas that have been perpetuated by the United States, the capitalist systems, about the reality of Cuba. And a lot of them we can struggle against and point out and decimate just by our study and our struggle and our discussions. Some of them we might actually need to go to Cuba to prove. We go to Cuba and we'll see the reality. We'll see the Africans who are struggling against the last remnants of racism there. We can see this. But I understand your question, my brother. Thank you.
Final thoughts, my brother. Then we'll move on. Okay, we'd like to thank you for your participation and continue to support Africa on the Move. We'll be coming on every Sunday from 7 to 9, so please share that with your friends and your network. The Africa is on the Move. It's a program that seeks to speak truth to power, and we're going to bring you all of the pertinent information that affects our community and humanity. Today, we are discussing the issue on the Cuban Five, particularly why the African community must come forward and support the Cuban Five. And with the discussion, one of the things we know that is coming up in the next week or so, there'll be 5 to 6 days of activities around the Cuban Five. And Brother Neffer, I'd like for you to give our audience some kind of update on what can we expect for the next couple of days of some of the major events that is coming up on the Cuban Five, and how can the people just participate?
Yeah. Okay, so coming up in June, from June 4th to the 11th, is the third 5 days for the Cuban Five. So this will be the third year that has been organized for 5 days for the Cuban Five. And like you said, it's actually a little bit more than 5 days, but, you know, we stated 5 days for the Cuban Five. And it's 5 days of activities that are designed to bring awareness to the issue of the Cuban Five, to harness the advocacy for their freedom. So a number of people will be doing things like meeting with parliamentarians from other countries, will be meeting with policymakers here or legislators here. I guess their country-to-country counterparts, to urge them to do what they can to convince for their freedom. And so other people will be joining them, people, citizens from the United States, so there will be like a lobby day. There will be a lot of conferences and workshops just talking about the Cuban Five and how the movement, the different areas of the movement, should be developed again, like, for instance, the faith-based community, a forum for the faith-based community, and how CAPES relates to their vision for a different world. And also, we will have a number of cultural activities. We'll have a rally in front of the White House, and we really want to encourage everyone to join us in front of the White House on June 7th at 1 p.m. That's a Saturday, June 7th at 1 p.m. We're going to gather in front of the White House for a rally to demand that President Obama and the Obama administration free the Cuban Five. Also, the previous day, we have a cultural activity. There will be a concert on June 6th, Friday, June 6th in the evening, in Columbia Heights, Washington, D.C. The renowned hip-hop duo Dead Prez is joining and adding their voice through their art to the call to free the Cuban Five, and they'll be accompanied at that concert by a number of local performers, various performers who are local in D.C., but have represented different music genres. We're talking about reggae, R&B, spoken word. I mean, so there'll be more than just hip-hop at this spectacular, what we're calling the mega meeting of art and empowerment music at this concert, and people can get tickets to the concert at deadprezforthecuban5.bpt.me. And there the tickets are, I can say the ticket cost and everything. So
you can say everything. Yes.
Okay. So there's a $20 concert, $20 advance ticket, $25 at the door. And so, but it'll be a great, you know, event. We have a lot of things. Some things I can't even mention in terms of surprises at the event. And we want to encourage people to come out. This will be the first time that Dead Prez or any, you know, big hip hop people came to add their voice to the movement of the Cuban Five. And so this is what's happening June 4th to 11th, and we want to encourage people to come down. We have a bus. It's not free. It's $5, a round-trip bus from New York, so people who are in New York can travel round-trip for $5 to for the day of the rally. That's June 7th, so you can come into the rally, join us at the rally, and go back. And so we have a number of activities. This proves to be each one gets bigger than the last in terms of how many people participate and then the impact that we make in terms of who shows up. We have people like luminaries like Dolores Huerta from, you know, the movement, movement for workers here. And we have Danny Glover, the activist Danny Glover coming to be part of this. A lot of different people, personalities coming in to be a part of the activities during that time. And so the idea is to build the jury of millions, as we say, that will, because of the fact that the most legal options for their release have been exhausted pretty much. And so we know that it's up to the force of the people and the organization of the people and the activities of the people to demand and get their freedom. And at the same time, we realize that as we fight for this, we hone in and sharpen our ability to advocate for our, you know, and actually include our other political prisoners, sisters and brothers who are facing incarceration, confinement by the state because they were fighting for people's freedom. And so listen, it's all connected, and we see this as connected, and this is going to be, I think it lends itself, it'll be historical that people get involved, and it's an example of, it represents the evolution of our movement and advancement and the growing of the people's struggle.
Okay.
And then we have the website for the 5 days. The website for the 5 days is 5 days, this is the number five, 5 days for the CubanFive.com or .org.com. And that people can get all the activities, the schedule of details, schedule of events on that website.
And Brother Neffa, can you speak just a little bit about the type of international support that the Cuban Five have been able to galvanize around? We know internationally it has wide appeal. Can you talk about that? And
internationally, the case of the Cuban Five has had wide appeal internationally for a very long time. I'm trying to find where all of the different representatives, the different parliamentarians will be coming to participate. But pretty much from all corners of the world, every major continent, there are people who have made statements and at the United Nations and submitted amicus briefs and calling for the release of the Cuban Five. During the 5 days, there'll be several countries around the world be at the same time that we're rallying in front of the White House. They're going to also be having demonstrations in front of the U.S. embassies in their country. And there's countries in every continent represented in those countries that are doing that and organized to do that.
Okay. And to Brother Haki, one of the things we mentioned earlier by Brother Bamboji, which I think is very important as we talk about this whole case of the Cuban Five and Cuba in general. Some of this information that people need to know and get a better understanding might be better if they would actually go to Cuba. Now, you with an organization called the African Women Association. As my understanding, they take a feeder ride to Cuba every year. Can you talk us a little bit about the organization and why do y'all go to Cuba and what you have coming up for this year? I believe African Women Association is scheduled to go to Cuba this year in the month of November and December, and we'd like to have any African who would like to go or just other people who want to see Cuba for themselves. I know they're always welcome to go on your delegation. Can you talk a little bit about the African Women Association and some of the things that you have seen as a result of going to Cuba yourself? And how can the people get in touch with you, your organization?
Yeah. Well, I think that
you know, have a, all people have a human right to travel. We take the position that Cubans are our brothers and sisters, and so therefore we got a right to go home to see them. So that's the position that we take. We do it in opposition to the U.S. blockade, criminal blockade, that is, in terms of denying the Cuban people the right to international trade, which is, in fact, something that's codified, you know, under the U.N. International law. We do this, not only do we do this every year, but we do it the idea that, you know, to solidify some friendships in terms of the Cuban people. The best way to understand, you know, Cuba is to go there yourself and see what you can see. And to actually talk to people and to go around to the institutions and ask questions. The beauty of the Cuban people, they're very, very open. And they have nothing to hide. And they talk freely in terms of whatever they're thinking. There's this misnomer that somehow the Cuban people, you know, are subjects of kind of tyrant, and they're afraid to articulate what they really feel, which is such craziness. In fact, if you look at America, Americans are more inclined to be close-lipped when it comes to actually telling what they feel, when, in particular, as it comes to articulating what you feel to people that you don't know. People are very, very afraid in this country to do that. And Cuba is a totally different ballgame. People are free to express, to articulate what they feel, and to contrast system. And that thing that I liked about them, in fact, that they can contrast. So as you talk to a lot of American citizens, and you try to get a sense of what they understand in terms of what's going on in the world, then you're likely to be unimpressed. But when you talk to Cubans in terms of what's going on in the world, and particularly the United States, they can run off a litany of stuff that's going on in the United States, stuff that you know, that most Americans are not even aware of going on right in front of their eyes. So Cuba is definitely a learning experience, and we encourage people to come. And like you said, we will be leaving in the fall. So, you know, and if people are interested in going along, they can contact Brother Africa at
804-549-7492, or they can write the African Awareness Association at African_Awareness_Association@yahoo.com. And we would love to have you to come with the African Awareness Association. And to my brother Bamboshi with the All African People Revolutionary Party and National Network on Cuba, I know those organizations have taken trips and sponsored trips, have supported trips, have supported this whole thing of supporting Cuba, particularly in terms of the historical legacy it has played towards assisting African freedom fighters, such as our recent brother who just recently made his transition, Brother Kwame Ture. Can you talk to the African people, Brother Bamboja, why it's important to come to Cuba and what some of the things they may see?
Could you repeat that? You say why we could.
Yes, can you just make a statement? Why is it important that your organization, the African People Revolutionary Party and the National Network on Cuba, support the Freedom Ride, travel resistance? They support the coming to Cuba, going to Cuba to see for themselves. They support the whole notion of socialism as being a viable alternative to capitalism. Can you just appeal to the people why it's important that they should go to Cuba and see for themselves?
Well, that's relatively easy. It's always better to know. It's always better for you to know yourself. And, of course, you know, as a people, we use a very small portion of our brain, and I can clearly say that we can never know too much. So we should know. We should want to know for whatever reasons. If you think Cuba is not what they say it is, go and prove it. If you think Cuba is what they say it is, go and prove it. It's strange that in the United States, most folks know very little about geography. And America's created enemies all over the world, yet still the American people know very little about these so-called enemies of America. So, if you think in that sense, if you think off to the right-wing sets of thinking, then you should also go to Cuba to see for yourself. Now, I just heard Netzer talk about the demonstration that will be held as part of the 5 Days for the Five. I think this is very important. and especially for people in the D.C. area who it would mean just getting on the bus and coming. It wouldn't mean taking a four-hour bus trip or anything. Just come down to Pennsylvania Avenue, because ultimately, when all of these legal proceedings are expired and there's no more left, it will only be the masses of the people in the United States who can free the five, all of the five. Today, you have at least three options. One, the masses of the people can force the government to freedom. Two, Obama can sign a paper saying that they are relieved of their sentence, an amnesty paper, and freedom. Or Obama can exchange them for the prisoner, the spy that they have, the American spy, who unknowingly was working as a spy for some small agency in Maryland who was hooked to USAID, and he could exchange the balance of the five for this one. And it would not be a precedent because the United States have exchanged prisoners all the time. All the time. So if we want the five free, they can be free. And again, I think it will come down to ultimately the people of America freeing all the five. And I think this is very important, and the sooner we do it, the better.
Okay, and Brother Bamboshi, just to let our audience know that one of the issues around Friend of Five and this whole issue that the brother stated earlier about how do we deal with these Colin Moore type of people in terms of how to give out disinformation, I think the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC, had an African Liberation Day recently. Can you just briefly talk a little bit about that theme and the role that the neocolonial intelligence should play? Maybe that's an issue that we need to look at, and if we can resolve that issue, I'm quite sure we'll be further along the road in terms of helping our brothers and sisters in Cuba to be free and helping to end this blockade against Cuba. Can you just talk a little bit about that theme and this year, African Liberation Day, to our people?
It's a complex theme. I could not do it justice in talking about it in 2 minutes. However, I must say that I would invite everybody to look at the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC's, webpage, which is www.aaprp-gc.org. And our parts of the information from the African Liberation Day is on that webpage, and the rest will be on there soon. So please, because this struggle against the neocolonial intelligentsia, those intelligentsia who work to justify colonialism and imperialism, is very key. So please look at that.
And to our listening audience, again, if you have any views or questions or comments, please punch 1, and you can call in at 323-679-0841. If you have any views or comments that you would like to make, please press 1, and we will acknowledge you. Brother Nefa, we have a few minutes left. We'd like for you again to talk about the upcoming events. How can they help join your organization, your movement?
So the upcoming events, they begin June 4th in Washington, D.C., and a number of places in Washington, D.C. We'll open up with a press conference at the National Press Club on June 4th at 10 a.m., and then the following day will be a two-day conference with people like Reverend Edgar Palacios, messages from Rene Gonzalez and Fernando Gonzalez, Rigoberto Menchu and Adolfo Perez Esquivel. And then also there'll be a plenary session with Reverend Joan Brown Campbell, Danny Glover, other people. And you know, that's on June 4th, and June 5th we'll have a number of things, workshops, several workshops talking about not just the, of course, you can only say so much about the Cuban Five case, but it's also talking about changing the relationship between the United States and Cuba, or at least trying to, you know, get Cuba from underneath the assault of the United States. How, what kind of movement should we be, because we can see that their case is connected to other things. And then the other broader movement. So the, just quickly, then we have the Dead Prez concert in the evening of the Friday evening, June 6th, a rally in front of the White House on June 7th, and then some lobby days on the preparation for lobbying on Sunday and lobbying on the Mondays and days after is going to the Hill to demand or to work with people to see how we can secure the freedom for our brothers. And everything is up on our website, 5daysforthecuban5.com. Those are the number 5, 5daysforthecuban5.com, where people can get plugged in, they can get tickets to the concert, they can get more information of the full schedule of things.
And if they want to join the movement, how would they do that?
Well, we have, there's a lot of things to do. People can, like, okay. Well, we have lots of people can do. Let me see. The best way is the contact information is to call us if you want to, if people are willing to volunteer for some things and actually even lend their ideas about how to secure their freedom. The phone number is 510-269-7915. Or 415-269-7917. You can put an endorsement on for the 5 days at the website, 5daysforthecuban5.com, to add your voice to it. And you can follow us on Twitter at thecuban5.com. And so those are ways to get connected to us. And if people reach out and say they have a particular interest to do something in particular, or they want us to plug them into some work, you know, there's enough to be done. We're more than willing to do that. And people should contact us.
And for Brother Bamboshi, in terms of closing, two questions. How can we put more pressure on the media to make them become more responsible around this issue of the Cuban Five? And at the same time, can you just give us your last closing thoughts on why we should support the Cuban Five and how?
Well, I think that we should wage the struggle of ideas. We should fight over these different ideas that are existing in society, those ideas that legitimize our oppression or exploitation. I think that it's our duty, nobody else's, it's our duty to fight against the ideas that have us down. And that by doing that, we will be able to organize ourselves and wage a struggle to elevate and to raise our consciousness, and thus we should be moving down the road to be free.
And Brother Haki, give us your take on your final thoughts on why we should support the Cuban Five. And how can the people come and help and aid the African Women's Association?
Well, we should support the Cuban Five because it's in our interest to support the Cuban Five. And we have to understand the changes that are taking place in society doesn't bode well in terms of the aspirations of all human beings. So we have an obligation to fight back. But in fighting back, we have to understand that these people are not going to sit by and allow us to simply, you know, carte blanche. Do we have to change the system? That's going to be resistance. So these kind of traffic is going to come up, happen again and again. So we have to support people like the Cuban Five. If they're interested in getting doing work with the African Awareness, then contact your brother gave you previously, and we'll get in contact with you.
Okay. In closing, we'd like to thank our listening audience. We'd like to thank our guests, Brother Bamboshi, Brother Aki, and Brother Nefa, for their presentation on the theme, supporting the Cuban Five and its relevancy to the African community. We'd like to just say that just ideals should be supported with just cause, and the best way to do this is by joining an organization that is fighting to bring about a better humanity. We have just introduced you to 3 organizations today in which you can be a member of. That's the African Awareness Association, the International Friends, the International Committee for the Friend of the Cuban Five, as well as the All African People's Revolutionary Party, FGC, and the National Network on Cuba. We know the organization is the weapon for the oppressed, and our people must be organized. If we're truly going to help Cuba and the Cuban Five, we must get organized. And with that, we'd like to thank you again for coming to your home today. Remember, Africa on the Move can be listened to on every Sunday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. Please share that with your network. And remember, we are here to serve the interests of the undeveloped community, the oppressed communities, and to speak truth to power. Until next time, let's grab and go forward ever, backward never. You have been listening to Brother Africa on Africa on the Move. Forward ever, backward never.